This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Seattle's world-renowned city council member and socialist firebrand Shama Sawant announced earlier this year that she would not be seeking re-election to her seat. After a decade as an elected official, Sawant has moved on to launch her own worker-led organization called Workers Strike Back and started a new podcast called On Strike. While on the city council, Sawant changed expectations for elected officials, refusing to bow down to financial and political pressures that most of her colleagues accepted, inviting loud and proud protests on issues of labor rights, fair wages, housing and rent, racial justice, caste discrimination, and much more. She was a thorn in the side of the establishment, faced and beat back recall efforts, and has been an ally to progressive causes inside the halls of power. She joins me today to look back at her achievements as an elected official and her hopes for her new ventures. Welcome to the program, Shama.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
It's amazing. I looked back on my archives and realized that you'd been such a regular on this program, almost a dozen conversations with you over the past decade, talking about everything that you've been doing and all the attacks you've faced, but more importantly, the ways in which you have challenged the establishment in Seattle. Why did you decide that 10 years was enough?
We've demonstrated so thoroughly an unparalleled example. Really, it's unfortunate that it's unparalleled, but that's how it is, of what it means to be a genuine working class representative standing up for the needs and interests of working people and oppressed community members. And what it means is exactly what we have demonstrated in this last decade, which is to be unambiguously loyal to the interests of the people you claim to represent, which automatically means you become enemy number one of the Chamber of Commerce, of big business and billionaire interests, and also the political establishment that represents their interests. And in Seattle, there's really no Republican establishment to speak of. The other eight council members on the Seattle City Council throughout this decade have always been Democrats. In fact, in the last 3 to 5 years, they've been a majority of self-described progressive and labor Democrats. And yet, for the most part, these politicians, and this is the bitter reality that people, working people, have to accept, which is that they for the most part represent the interest of big business despite their progressive labels that they put on themselves. And so what we have shown is that it takes using this elected office as a vehicle for social struggle, for working people's and young people's movements, to win any kind of victory, let alone significant ones like the ones we have won, which is making Seattle the first major city to win the $15 an hour minimum wage, launching the 15 Now movement, which went nationwide, winning the Amazon tax on billionaires, corporate billionaires who have basically used the Washington state as a tax haven, and winning unprecedented renters' rights victories, including victories against oppression, which is, as you mentioned, the landmark historic bill, the outlawing of caste-based discrimination in Seattle, which is the biggest victory against caste oppression outside South Asia ever won.
Right. And we almost had it in California, and our Democratic liberal governor, Gavin Newsom, vetoed it.
Yes, and I think, Sonali, that is actually worth talking about. Why is it that we won in Seattle and why that bill was defeated in California? That story itself encapsulates exactly what I'm saying here in response to your question about, why not run for re-election this year. So I think after a decade of having demonstrated successfully a fighting strategy that is independent of the Democratic Party, we believe that the lessons of what we have won here should not remain just limited to Seattle. And that is why, rather than run for re-election, Socialist Alternative, my organization and I, as you mentioned, have launched Worker Strike Back, which is a nationwide organization and movement to help organize rank and file union members and non-union workers, because for the most part, the workforce is not unionized in the United States because of the decades of attacks on the labor movement.
It also speaks, I think, to the sense of not wanting to get too entrenched in a particular position, right? Shama, I mean, a lot of city council members and elected officials, when you get some power and you realize you can wield it, like to stay there or maybe aim for higher office and keep climbing the political ladder. And that we have this system and a culture of political establishmentarianism, I think, in the United States that encourages elected officials to seek office for the sake of seeking office rather than for the sake of changing things. And I think your stepping down sort of speaks to something as well. I'm wondering if you can pinpoint that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should not underestimate, which I don't think your question is doing, but just to begin responding to that question by first laying out the framework of why it is actually important for working class people and those of us, you know, the millions of Americans who are not represented by the Democrats and Republicans, for us to have our own elected office that unambiguously fights for us and does not make backroom deals with the establishment, you know, with the Democratic Party politicians, including the progressives. So I don't think we can underestimate the importance of having such a position and using it in the way we have done. But at the same time, we also recognize that when we look at the history of American working class, for example, winning victories, many of those were not won because we had an elected position. Many of those were won because we had the correct kind of leadership in every sphere. So what I mean is that whether we have an elected position in City Hall or in Congress, or we're talking about leadership of the labor movement or informal leadership of social movements or social struggle, regardless of which sphere we're talking about, what we as in rank and file working people who are watching this and are hungry for social change, are angry at the Democrats and Republicans, what we should be aiming for is leadership that the rank and file can hold accountable. And that's an example of we've shown an example of that. But I'm trying to really emphasize that it is not specifically about elected leadership. It is about leadership that originates from social struggle. All of this has to be held accountable. And you're absolutely right, Sonali. What we see, not just in the Republican Party, but also in the Democratic Party, we see personality-based politics, which is entirely rooted in personal careerism, as in all these so-called progressive Democrats like Pramila Jayapal, Ro Khanna, Teresa Mosqueda here in Seattle. These are all careerist politicians, which means that they put their position in the Democratic Party ladder, you know, the career ladder, far ahead of any principle they might profess to have been the basis of their political, you know, starting point of their political work or political activism, really. So ultimately, careerism is the death knell for the working class. And the only way we can push back against that is to push back against that idea of politics itself. And so what we have done in Socialist Alternative is completely reject. It's not just not only about the fact that, you know, we put forward working class demands, which is obviously fundamentally different than what the Democratic Party does, which is they don't ever make any promises either. I mean, if you look at what they're actually saying, they don't actually make concrete promises because they don't want to be held to any concrete promise. But in addition to that, just the whole model of politics that they present is they're busy climbing the rungs of the political establishment, which means at every step of the way, you sell out those who are vulnerable, those who are marginalized, poor people, working class people. So in other words, if renters, for example, are fighting for renter for their rights to, which it automatically means that if you as an elected person are going to actually stand with renters, and I want everybody who's watching this to hear me correctly, not say that you're with renters, but actually stand with renters, that comes as a package with making enemies out of corporate landlords. So there is no way you can keep corporate landlords happy and fulfill the needs of renters, because under capitalism, the needs of those who are left out, as in the vast majority of working people and the poor, and the greed of the billionaire class and the political establishment and NGO leaders and all of them that feed on them, that these two things are diametrically opposed to each other. So any politician who's saying I can represent both, I'll keep everyone happy, is either deluding themselves or are trying to fool you.
Now, the way in which the Democratic Party establishment, of course, also works is that if you speak out of turn, you can't take advantage of their machine for your re-election hopes. And so for you, Shama, as an independent, as somebody who was linked to Socialist Alternative, an independent political grassroots organizing effort, how did that, different approach keep you, first of all, accountable to grassroots, and then also not beholden to relying on an establishment to keep, you know, funding your re-election campaigns over 10 years, for example?
I think one of the things that is least understood, because we haven't had an example like our elected office, is what happens once you get elected. And what happens, is that the machinery, the political machinery of capitalism exists to defend the interests of the system, to defend the interests of those who benefit from the system. So by definition, the what we consider government under capitalism, whether it is City Hall or U.S. Congress, is not fundamentally set up to deliver justice or betterment in society. It exists there to manage the inherent conflicts that arise from having a deeply divided system, where you have a minority benefiting in the system and the vast majority not benefiting and actually losing out, and the others, the small minority at the top benefiting at the expense of the rest of us. So when you have that kind of deep inequality underlying in society, then automatically what it means is that the way the government institutions, all of institutions of the capitalist government, the way they are set up is to basically manage all of these interests. And for the most part, the way they, when I say manage, what they mean, what it means is that for the most part, they deliver what is demanded by the ruling elite, but they try to do it especially in developed countries like the United States, the way they try to do it is by maybe offering a few crumbs here and there for ordinary people. And so if you accept that model, then as I said before, you've already sold out. Because if you accept that model, then you are not going to understand that your role is not to join in the managing of the capitalist system. Your role as an elected representative is to disrupt that status quo. And the best and most effective way you can disrupt it is, it's not about just making speeches. It's the most effective way of disrupting the status quo is to actually win significant victories for the working class. And the way you win is by recognizing that you have to change the balance of power. And the only way the balance of power can shift towards working people, away from the elite, at any given moment under capitalism, is if working people build mass movements to tip the scales in their favor. And so fundamentally, if that would be our role as working class representatives, to use our office as a vehicle to build that kind of movement in order to tip the scales in the favor of working people, because no one person, however extraordinary they might be, is going to achieve that. So, if you go with the mindset that, oh, I'm a good person, I got elected, and I'm going to win these victories for for the people I represent, then you are beholden to the the machinery and, you know, beholden to the beneficence of that machinery. And, you know, AOC at one moment was actually quite honest. You know, she and the squad have completely failed in delivering anything for working people. And in fact, they've also sold out by actually, for example, AOC signing the Iron Dome or voting present on the Iron Dome vote and, you know, in relation to the Israeli state's machinery, war machinery against Palestinians in Gaza, by voting to break the railroad worker strike. I mean, there's any number of examples, but she had a moment of honesty recently when she said that if you go against, and this goes to your question, Sonali, if you go against the Democratic Party in any real serious way, then it causes, in her words, this is a quote from her, relational harm. And that really goes to the, I don't know if she meant to be honest in this way, but that goes to the crux of the difference between someone like her and someone like me, in the sense that if you believe that your personal relationship with the Democrats, with the power brokers, is important to you because your day-to-day life should not be too hard, then that's it. All is lost. You have sold out by definition. So I can tell you from my own example that my life has been the exact opposite, in the sense that Democrats, including the progressive Democrats, including women, Latina women Democrats, have, you know, on a personal level, if you look at it, I have any number of stories of how badly they have treated me. But that's the point. It is politics. And if you are steadfastly representing working people, expect to be treated badly by the Democrats. But understand that you are not there for your personal comfort, and they are not your work colleagues. This is not like workers in a workplace who should actually be in solidarity with one another. I am not in solidarity with the representatives of the capitalist class. So when I go to work in City Hall, I don't look at it as a normal workplace where these are my colleagues. I look at it as a battleground, because that's what it is. It's a political battleground. And unless you understand that, you won't really understand what our role is.
I'm wondering, Shama, if you have found over your 10 years in the city council that you had colleagues that privately agreed with you about the issues that you were pushing and then explained, you know, in a way that AOC did publicly, that they couldn't side with you or wished that you would tone down your ask, or then they could support you. I'm wondering if you can, you know, what you can reveal, if anything, about the private conversations we had with your colleagues who, you know, maybe don't want people to know that they felt forced to sell out or made choices that, you know, resulted in them selling out.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you an example, you know, without really like naming any individual, but I can tell you a very concrete sort of reality that comes out from exactly what you're talking about, this phenomenon of somebody who might, as an individual, want to do the right thing, but then feels the pressures of the establishment and the elite and all kinds of power brokers against them. One example is what happened in 2018. I don't know if you remember, Sonali, but in 2018, we won the blowout historic victory of the Amazon tax in 2020 in the midst of the George Floyd protests. But before that, we had already won a much smaller, actually, Amazon tax in 2018. And that was repealed less than a month after we won it.
Right. And that was repealed by the city council.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, honestly, I think at that moment, at that time, a majority of the 9 council members, I mean, I'm one socialist, as I said, the other 8 are Democrats. But I believe already at that time, a majority of them considered progressive, you know, they called themselves progressives. And so in other words, progressive council members repealed the Amazon tax, and that was under direct pressure from corporations like Amazon and corporate executives and billionaires like Jeff Bezos. But we have to be clear, at that time, the people who helped the billionaire class to repeal this was not just themselves, but also some, and this is one of the most shameful aspects of that episode, some labor leaders and some NGO leaders. They participated in this historic sellout, and often even there, I mean, at that time, there was at least one really, really genuine Democrat who had actually agreed with me on many things and we had actually worked together on the other legislation, felt the pressure of this. You know, it wasn't just the billionaire class, but it was labor leaders and NGO leaders as well. And at that time, my conversation with them went something like not just telling them, but, you know, really strenuously urging them. I believe I was, my memory of that is that I was almost in tears saying, you are going to regret voting yes on this repeal because you will never be able to undo it. You know, once you vote for the repeal of a tax on the billionaire class that is meant to provide affordable housing for the working class and the poor of Seattle, how will you ever live it down? You know, you will have done it and that's it. It will never go from your record. And if you want to be a progressive person, you can't do this. Don't make this mistake. And at that time, their response was that there were labor leaders who were saying it. And I said, so what? They're on the wrong side of history. And shame on them for doing that. And you should instead expose, you should stand on the dais and name those who are urging you to vote yes on this repeal, because that's what I would do. And I have a story on $15 an hour, similar of a similar nature. And then the other worry that they had, this Democrat had, was that there was a growing big business-backed, corporate landlord-backed right wing in their district. You know, we are elected district-wide, and they were worried that if they didn't vote yes on this repeal, then they would be defeated in the next election. And you know what my response for that was? My response was, the big business interests are never going to consider you their person. They will always want an unambiguous fighter for them, just as working people want an unambiguous fighter like me. So they are never going to choose you as their candidate. And instead, if you participate in this repeal, what you're going to end up doing is anger working people. And so you will be in a, you know, it's in a twilight zone where nobody's supporting you. So I think that story, it's not so much important about the individuals who were involved, but what is the political lesson of that story? The political lesson of that story is, as a matter of fact, if you are genuinely trying to represent the interests of those who are completely forgotten in this capitalist system, then the only way to do it is to do it unambiguously and to never sell out and to be unshakable. Because if you start speaking from both sides of your mouth, you are not going to you're not going to empower working people, and you're never going to be that big business candidate, because big business wants their own candidates. I think another lesson of this story also is that it is not only the Democratic politicians who are some people to watch out for. The people to watch out for are also other people around them. You know, the whole story of BLM misleaders, you know, where you had the largest street protest movement in US history, and yet the gains of the BLM movement were nowhere commensurate to the size and scale of the movement. And that's because so many of these NGO leaders sold out the majority of Black people.
You were among the protesters during the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. Another issue that, of course, is front and center now as you and I are speaking is Israel's war on Gaza, Israel's assault on Gaza, genocidal assault on Gaza, which is, you know, another issue that the Democrats are unshakable on. They are uncompromising in their support for Israel. And you've led in, I think, what might be your last major issue on the city council, calls for your colleagues to back a citywide, you know, for the city of Seattle to call for a ceasefire. Tell me about this particular move and whether you see this issue as well as one that your colleagues may regret being on the wrong side of history of.
I think all the interests related to the Democratic Party who are either actively participating or quietly, tacitly allowing the warmongering to continue are absolutely going to be on the wrong side of history, as you and I know, Sonali, and many of the people who are watching this will know. In fact, this is such a historic moment where there's been a generational shift in the United States, where the younger generation is not going along with the pro-Israeli straight propaganda. And let's be clear on the outset, being against the Israeli state does not make you anti-Semitic. In fact, we are fighting against both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. We are fighting against oppression of any kind, no matter what community it is. We are against oppression internationally.
And huge numbers of Jewish Americans are fighting in solidarity with Palestinians.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, there have been some of the most courageous actions have been the nonviolent civil disobedience actions, like at the Grand Central Station in New York City, like in the halls of Congress. In fact, those actions were, in addition to the anti-war protests as a whole, were what finally forced the chair of the Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, to at least start talking about ceasefire. I mean, but as you said correctly, and I totally agree, none of them is actually fighting for ceasefire, but the protests actually are forcing them. Now, Ro Khanna is saying he supports ceasefire, but nobody's actually going to take a real stand against the warmongering of their own party. You know, so, you know, the story is that on November 7th, I brought forward a resolution condemning the Israeli state's war on Gaza, also condemning Hamas for the violence and pointing out that that kind of terrorism is not the way to solve it. And in fact, it actually worsens and compounds actions of terror, and that we are against the state terror conducted by Israel, and the complete inhumanity of killing thousands of babies and children and women and elderly. And the unspeakable horrors that they're perpetrating on the Palestinian people in Gaza, especially, but also in the occupied West Bank. And not only calling for ceasefire, the resolution also called for the ending of U.S. funding for the Israeli state's war machine, and calls for the end of the occupation of Palestinian lands, and also, you know, raised its voice against anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. So what happened on November 7th was another shameful moment in the annals of the Democrats on the Seattle City Council, which is that I did not even get a second for my motion for the resolution. And it was incredible in the sense that it really angered the rank and file of the anti-war movement. It included many Palestinian Americans, but it was by no means limited to Palestinian Americans. Working people, union members of all ethnicities and nationalities who live in Seattle were absolutely angered. Based on the basis of that phenomenal support we had from the anti-war protests in Seattle, in our office, we brought that resolution back for a vote on November 21st. And Sonali, it was just amazing. Like you said, you know, here we are wrapping up our city council tenure and in our almost final days, we had this moving city council meeting where we were able to mobilize over 500 people. Many of them came from the anti-war protests, from the Palestinian community, from the Jewish community, working people, union members. It was incredible. I had tears in my eyes, you know, just looking at the incredible opposition to warmongering, and many of them saying in public testimonials, saying, here we are, our public schools are crumbling, many of them are being shut down, people are becoming homeless, rent is sky high in Seattle, home ownership is completely out of reach for most people, and all these tens of billions of dollars being handed to a war machine that is spilling blood of innocent people overseas. We don't accept this. So just the political analysis that was presented by ordinary people was also just tremendous. And what do you think the Democrats did in the face of this, including those Latina Democrats and so on? None of them, first of all, showed up in person because, you know, you have a Zoom option. But imagine staying at home, or worse yet, many of them were in City Hall, but they didn't dare face the 500 people who had come to City Hall. You know, Sonali, it was just incredible. It's just embarrassing in how shameful they are, that they were literally hiding. And I don't mean, I'm not exaggerating. They literally were hovering just outside the chambers in this private, an entrance that nobody else can go in because it's a key card entrance. And then refusing to come inside the city council chambers, but heading back into their private offices and doing this meeting over Zoom. And I can't tell you how much that angered the people. They're like, you know, we are here because thousands upon thousands of people, including babies, are dying, and you can't even bother to show up. No matter which way you're voting, at least have the courage to face us. But they didn't have the courage. I was the lone person on the city council dais. And then not only did they not show up, they had the temerity to water down the resolution. So at the end of the day, the resolution that we won was watered down by them. And that's, you know, that's shame on the Democrats. At the same time, I think we have to also take note of the fact that that night, Seattle became the largest city in the United States to win a ceasefire resolution. And the Democrats were absolutely loath to do anything, you know, as indicated by the first time when they didn't even give me a second in my motion. But the fact that they were forced to vote on this, that shows the power of anti-war movements. And we need this movement to grow, and we need real leadership in this movement.
Shama, we just have a few minutes left. I want to ask you about what's next for you. Tell me about Workers Strike Back and On Strike, your new podcast. Maybe you can begin by reflecting on the fact that the United Auto Workers became the largest union to call for a ceasefire on the Israel's war on Gaza, just indicating the power of organized labor to be militant and achieve success.
I think that's very, very important what you've mentioned. The UAW calling for a ceasefire in the wake of their own historic victory through the strike action that they did against all the three, you know, the big three automakers, Ford, GM, and Stellantis. I think this is incredible. It shows that this is what the labor movement needs to be doing, you know, calling for strike actions and going on strike to win workplace victories, and at the same time, taking a stand on the issues that, on issues of oppression, and taking a position on an international issue. It really is an inspiring example, a brilliant example of what the labor movement should be doing. And it's really important also to mention that in the wake of their victory after their strike, they have not stopped there. Not only did they call for this ceasefire, but they are also have put a call out. Sean Fain, the president of UAW, has put a call out for unionizing the auto workforce as a whole. And I think that's been really inspiring. I'm hearing of a lot of workers sort of writing to UAW saying, I want to unionize my workplace. And I think making that concretely happen is very important. And all of this that we're talking about UAW also relates to another historic unionizing drive that is going on, which is at Amazon's world's largest air hub, which is in Northern Kentucky at the Cincinnati, Kentucky, Northern Kentucky Airport. They call it KCVG. It's a, as I said, it's the largest air hub of Amazon in the world. It's a linchpin in their whole machinery. So in other words, if KCVG workers shut it down, then all of Amazon's, you know, worldwide project will be disrupted. And so it's a real choke point for Amazon. And it's, that's what makes this unionizing drive so historic right now that's happening.
And those are the kinds of stories you're covering on your podcast?
Those are the kinds of stories we're covering on our video broadcast, On Strike. People can check it out. If you go to YouTube and search On Strike Show, you'll find it. And in fact, our most recent episode, which was released, it's a weekly video broadcast, and the episode from last week actually is an update on this KCVG struggle, because we launched this broadcast with a story on this union drive, historic union drive, and we went back to KCVG last week. And the reason we went back is because the union drive is really heating up, and that also means that the union busting by Amazon bosses is also ramping up. And it's really important, everybody who is watching this, to stand in solidarity with the KCVG workers. So I really urge everybody who's watching this to go to workersstrikeback.org, all one word, workersstrikeback, to help us build this campaign. Please donate to Workers Strike Back, because a lot of those funds we use to help the union drive like KCVG. We've also been on the picket lines in solidarity with UAW. And I should just mention, Workers Strike Back is not just an abstract organization. We are concretely fighting for living wages and $25 an hour minimum wage, for union jobs for all, Medicare for all. Workers Strike Back is also fighting against discrimination and oppression. And last but not least, Worker Strike Back is also declaring that the Democrats and Republicans have both failed us and that working people in the United States need a party of our own. And I think there's never been, just talking about that last demand, there's never been a more favorable moment for the left to provide leadership to, you know, building towards a new or political organization for working people. Because look at the anger. I mean, obviously, there's massive anger against the Republicans and also against Trump. But in reality, there is a real danger of Trump 2.0, not because the majority of Americans favor him, but because of the anger that working people and young people correctly feel at Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. I mean, the degree to which Biden's approval rating has plummeted, both because of the failure to provide for basic economic needs of working people and young people, and also the warmongering, especially in relation to the Israeli state against Gaza, has completely plummeted the numbers. And in fact, among Arab Americans, now we have a hashtag trending, hashtag abandon Biden, which is all showing you that there is deep anger against the Democrats. But what's missing is the actual alternative. If you abandon Biden, which I agree with, but what else? You're not going to vote for Trump. Who else? And so all of this really opens up the need for an organization like Workers Strike Back that will help to mobilize and organize the rank and file inside the labor movement, and also those who are not don't have a union, but working and young people who want to fight back both in their workplace and against the warmongering. And that's, you know, Workers Strike Back is showing an example of the kind of political organizations we need.
Shama, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Give out those websites again for Workers Strike Back and the podcast. I guess you can find it on the same website.
Yes, you can definitely find On Strike. If you go to workersstrikeback, all one word, .org, you can find the link to On Strike as well. But if you just directly want to go to the video broadcast, just go on YouTube and search On Strike Show.
And we'll post links to that from our website. Shama, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll be having you back on as you step down from your decade on the Seattle City Council. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much, Sonali. And I should mention, we would love to have you on our On Strike broadcast.
Oh, I'd love to be on. Thank you so much again. My guest has been Shama Sawant. She's a member of Socialist Alternative, becoming and had become the first socialist in a century to be elected to the Seattle City Council. And she's been on the council for a decade, stepping down now and going on to work on her new organization, Workers Strike Back, and also as the host of a new video podcast called On Strike. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media, and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.